We are at the Grand Lubecan Resort, just outside Tahoe City in California, one of the Keystone Symposia on new insights into health span and diseases of aging, from molecular to functional senescence, with David Sinclair. This is a return visit. We did a conversation with you end of last year. And your colleague Jennifer Cermak is here as well, gave a talk on targeting sirtuins, drug development for diseases of aging. But that your talk's she was talking mostly about SIRT1. Let's get into the terminology in a minute. You're talking about something else. You're talking about regulation of the spindle checkpoint, senescence and aging by SIRT2.
Right.
Could you explain that in layman's terms, what we're talking about?
I'll try.
All the initials?
These SIRT genes, there are seven of them in our bodies. These are the sirtuins that we're learning more and more about. Still a lot to learn. But what we know so far is that these genes seem to, in anything from a yeast to a human, have a way of promoting health. And the real gold rush now for the field of sirtuin biology is to understand what do these seven genes actually do. And then the ultimate goal of all that research, I believe, is to use that knowledge to make medicines and improve human lives. And we're doing both of those things right now.
Right. I mentioned to you earlier that on the airport in the way here, I picked up Michael Pollan's latest little book, which is called Food Rules, an eater's manual. And obviously, this is full of bits of advice that your grandmother could have given you, as we talked about last time we had a conversation. There's obviously lots of things that you can do in terms of your dietary habits, your exercise, and so on, without resorting to anything pharmacological, medicines, and so on. You're talking about medicines here which can improve. So are we talking about improving the average person, or are we talking about coping with pathologies or putting off pathologies? Let's be clear,
I'm one of these scientists that believes that aging is or should be regarded as a disease, because if you don't regard it as a disease, you're not going to bother trying to treat it or prevent it. So this is a thing that most of us have to go through in our lives if we're lucky enough to get old enough. But it's a set of diseases and a deterioration in our function that I think that we should work hard towards delaying and treating. And what we're actually discovering now that we get into the molecular details of understanding aging and how it's controlled is that the same pathways that can slow down aging are also seemingly beneficial in treating pre-existing conditions that are associated with aging. So what I mean by that is the same molecules that we found can improve health span of a mouse can be given with an injection or something quite rapid and quite within weeks bring back a type 2 diabetic mouse to normal. What that actually means is that aging research has implications not just for extending lifespan or health span, but also for developing medicines that we're currently familiar with for treating diseases like type 2 diabetes, but also things like Alzheimer's, cancer, inflammation, like arthritis. And this is how I think the drugs of the future that will extend lifespan will come onto the market as prescribed medicines for diseases that exist. But if they're safe enough, they'll be used also as preventative measures to extend lifespan.
So almost in the same fashion, just to give an example, as using, I don't know, ibuprofen or non-specific anti-inflammatory things that you can buy in a pharmacy, that you see these things as being a kind of a slightly more heavy-duty version of putting off these kind of diseases which make old age unpleasant.
Well, it's more than slightly more heavy-duty. We're talking about a future, and I hope we see this in our lifetimes, but I'm certain it will happen, that you'll be able to go to Walmart or Costco or just a generic company that's selling these molecules that have been proven to be safe over decades, and you buy them off the shelf and you take one a day. I myself, like millions of other people, take an aspirin once a day, but instead of preventing cardiovascular disease, we're talking about a pill that could ward off most of the diseases that kill us. And we have the technology now, I think, to make such a pill. It's a matter of whether it'll work, and do we have the money? Do we have the climate to be able to make, what I mean by that, the business climate, to be able to make these molecules a reality?
All right, so tell me how difficult this is. I mean, you set up a company, Certris, right? GlaxoSmithKline acquired the company, well known, as we said in the earlier conversation, for the red wine, the resveratrol story, which you knew, honest. And it's obviously drinking vast amounts of red wine a day is not the story here. That's we've dealt with that before. There are some complications, apparently. Some critiques have emerged and so on and so forth. That's fairly natural, I suppose. I mean, what state are you at this point?
Yeah, well, trying to do something that big that very few people have done before it's tough. You know, I'll freely admit that, you know, it hurts to read stuff on the web. There are critics, people saying that, Sinclair's a shyster, he's just after the money, which is complete rubbish. I'm trying to make medicines here. But if you look at my career, just as an example, seemingly every paper we put out begins in a controversial way. And it is draining, it's tiring, it's hard to do, but it certainly makes life interesting. Now, the latest, like in all new science, there's controversies. The latest is that GSK is making molecules that will, they say, activate sirtuins and treat diseases of aging. And there's tens of millions of dollars in many years and probably thousands of people involved in these projects. So with what they've seen, this is very clear path forward, and the science is right. There's a paper that was put out by another company that challenges the mechanism by which the drugs work. And right now, the two companies, right now, they just agree to disagree. And what I'm confident of is that science is self-correcting and the truth will prevail. And actually, it'll come down in the next couple of years, perhaps, to whether the drugs actually work as advertised. And they certainly do wonderful things in mice. There's no question that not just resveratrol, but these other molecules, the thousands of molecules that Glaxo now has tried, do make mice much healthier. And these are ranging from diseases of Alzheimer's through to heart disease, and even muscle building and frailty. But the real proof of the pudding will be in the next few years. Do they work in humans? And, you know, we'll see. But if nothing more, what I hope to have done is to have shown that it's worth taking a risk, that large pharmaceutical companies can be interested in aging. And, you know, it may not be them, it may not be me that's involved in the first drug made. I hope it is. But it does show that it's worth taking the risk. And hopefully within our lifetimes we'll see this all come to fruition.
So you mentioned this. I mean, let me just make it quite clear. We're not in the business of gotcha television here. I'm actually interested in finding out how a process works like that. You mentioned that there's a couple of papers come out from Amgen and Pfizer or something. These are competing drug companies, right?
Yeah.
So for somebody sitting at home, right, who would follow the stories that Nick Wade did in the New York Times and so on, what are they to make of this sort of little battle that starts going on? Is that an off ramp, or I'm just trying to get some clarity on this, so for the average reader.
Well, the people who have been in the field for years, let's take for example Lenny Guarenti. We've seen hundreds of papers confirming that sirtuins are good for health and that you can activate them with these molecules. So that science is right. The Nicholas Wade story isn't disproven or going away. Right. It's the nuance, and what Pfizer and Amgen are challenging is, do these molecules directly bind to the enzyme and make it work better, or are they hitting something else which then makes it work better? So it's a nuance, and the whole story is not going away. It's really a question of how do these drugs actually work.
So what I'm interested in is, will that shift the way in which your research goes? In fact, could it be a positive thing? You think, well, okay, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting new direction. Let's explore that one. I don't know how you proceed from this point.
No, we've known about what Pfizer rediscovered since 2005. In fact, there are a couple of papers out there saying that the assay that's used to find activators, there are a whole variety of them, and some show activation, some don't. So we've known this phenomenon for years. So that's nothing new to the field. And most of the kerfuffle has come from people who don't know the literature,
right.
The media, the bloggers, who don't realize that this issue came up years ago and we've moved on from there already. The other second thing that came out of the Pfizer study was that they claim that the molecule 1720 kills mice. Now, I'm not in any way concerned about that, other than it doesn't fit with the five or so published studies that are out there with that molecule, nor the study that's going to be presented at this conference, that SRT-1720 has been fed to mice for the latter half of their lifespan, for 80 weeks, without any toxicity. In fact, they're healthier. So I don't understand how Pfizer shows these molecules kill mice when other groups have published and will present here that it's beneficial.
So this is the usual science as usual, which is the point we made last time, which is that people expect some definitive certitude from it. In fact, it's this process which goes on and on and on, shifting, changing, amending, changing trajectories and so on.
It's normal, and the path is forward, and there are challenges, and there are deviations, there are reinterpretations, but we haven't taken a major step back here. We're just scientists trying to understand how things are actually working. Yeah. Now, I don't think anyone can argue with the fact that these molecules like resveratrol do amazing things. The question that we're all trying to understand is exactly how.
Yeah. So, but in this talk that you're going to give today, yeah. or tomorrow, where you're talking about SIRT2,
mm-hmm.
and some you're talking about you on the way over here. You were talking about Alzheimer's and so on. I mean, could you talk about this new work and so on? How that's developing?
Well, there are seven of these SIRT genes,
right?
And my lab and many others have worked primarily on the first gene called SIRT1, and there's much less known about the other six genes. And so, what I'm going to be talking about is new work from the lab on numbers 2 and number 3. And what we're finding is consistent with the idea that sirtuins are good for health. And what we're seeing is that, again, we're using mice and cells, but mice and cells that don't have these sirtuin genes are predisposed to diseases like Alzheimer's, enlarged heart, aging of the heart, premature aging,
right.
As well as cancer. And so we're understanding exactly the molecular details of how these sirtuins actually promote health, and why these mice that don't have these genes are sensitive to diseases of aging. And the ultimate goal with all of this understanding is we may be able to use not just SIRT1, which is the focus of the drug development, but perhaps some other sirtuins to make even more potent drugs that can ward off diseases.
So do you know anything about 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7? I mean,
well, the field does, yeah. A lot of progress has been made about, for example, SIRT6. We heard a talk here today, and a new paper from Roel Mostislavsky, who has found that SIRT6 controls metabolism, sugar metabolism in the mouse body, probably ourselves as well. But more and more, every few months, there's another breakthrough paper with the sirtuins. We're almost at the point where you have to ask, gosh, what's the downside of all this good news? And we're still looking. Lenny Gorenti presented at this meeting a potential downside, and that is that if you activate SIRT1 in a certain region of the brain, you might affect fertility, and that might be a trade-off. That's one thing to look for in clinical trials.
Oh, this goes back to Tom Kirkwood's soma hypothesis, right?
Right. See, I'm not concerned about fertility, but that's based on empirical work. With the resveratrol studies in lower organisms and in mice, we haven't seen any negative impact on fertility. But it's just something to look out for based on the new work that Lenny's presenting.
So I mean, the basic argument would be that you can't just do one thing. That if you're improving the aging profile, you could at the same time, since the organism has to limited amount of resources, bioenergetic resources, mm-hmm. that it could be devoting less resources to reproductive success.
Right. Well, that's
is that roughly.
That's how we think of it. A number of researchers, Tom Kirkwood, has made some seminal theories and papers in that regard. The worry has always been there that if we are able to extend lifespan by mimicking caloric restriction, will we have the downsides? Will we see increased osteoporosis or reduced fertility, which can be associated with caloric restriction? So far, we haven't seen that. And maybe one of the lucky breaks that we have is that if these drugs don't get into the brain, they won't trigger this effect on reproduction. So we might get all the positive benefits in the drug without any of the negative side effects. And so far, so good. The mice seem to be doing well that are on the drugs. And people are taking the drugs right now for type 2 diabetes. And there are no major side effects that I know of. So we'll know pretty soon if they work, or at least have the first sign if they work. And then there'll be a number of follow-up studies if that happens.
Resveratrol, in technical terms, it would be a caloric restriction mimetic, right? So in other words, it's having the same...
Well, you know, I see people say that that's rubbish, but if you go to the literature, there are studies not just from my lab and from Rafa de Cabos, but Richard Weinbruch, who's arguably the world's expert on caloric restriction, or one of, who's published two papers on this too. There's a whole group of papers that say that resveratrol mimics the physiology of caloric restriction. I'm not sure why people say it doesn't, but I think that that's pretty solid. And then the question is, can we turn this into a medicine? And resveratrol probably isn't that molecule, but we need something more potent in a small pill.
Is this sort of depressing to go through this kind of a phase, or is it just something that you regard as being part of the business, the way
well,
things go?
You know, I'm only human. For every five people who are excited by the research, there is one or two who, you know, enjoy the fight, enjoy the debate. But it's been constant through the last decade, the ups and downs. But the ultimate goal is worth pursuing. You know, if we really can prevent people from suffering. You know, one of my colleagues who is developing the Sirtis drugs, his wife has probably terminal liver cancer. Now, trying to help people like that, this is a goal that's worth putting up with the criticism and the stress and the hard work and the sleepless nights. So I'm going to press on.
Yeah. Hopefully not affecting your longevity at this point.
Yeah. My three kids, they...
Yeah, we talked about that.
They're causing me to age prematurely as well.
This meeting, anything novel that you've heard about, anything particularly exciting, anything particularly interesting directions that you see the field going in?
Well, there's a lot. The one that is first and foremost on my mind is the one that was just given by Judith Campisi from the Buck Institute. Right. Now, what Judy's been saying discovering for years is that when cells senesce, or when they stop dividing and get old and stop dividing, they secrete factors that these factors might drive cancer. And so this might be why, as we get older, we're more predisposed to cancer. And there's really a lot of evidence for that. But what she showed in her talk at this conference is that when you look at the cells that are old and senescent, there are these little dots within the cell, in the nucleus, where things are aggregating, and that somehow is causing these cells to be bad and secrete bad factors. And what's exciting about that, from a personal perspective, is that we've proposed in my lab that the movement of proteins to certain places in the genome and them getting stuck there drives the aging process. And what she showed is perfectly consistent with this hypothesis that it's not the the DNA that's getting damaged per se that's the cause of aging. It's the protein response to that damage. So proteins are piling on to regions of DNA damage, and they stay there, and they don't go back to where they came from. And perhaps that reassociation of proteins in the nucleus and moving around is what's driving aging, and the changes in which genes are coming on and being turned off in old age. So that's exciting. There's another one also in the same session. Eduardo Chini showed that he can upregulate NAD levels. So what NAD is, it's a molecule that is required by sirtuins. So this could be a way to activate the whole sirtuin family and have even greater effects than individually trying to activate each one. And he's finding these mice that have more NAD are resistant to diabetes and obesity, as we would hope they would be. But there's really a lot going on in the field. It's a very exciting time.
So the trick often it seems to be here is how to optimize mechanisms. So that, let me give you an example of what I mean there. In Anjay Bhatt's talk, where he's talking about the positive or negative effects of growth hormone. And the fact that growth hormone can increase muscle mass, for example, in the condition called sarcopenia, but it doesn't increase muscle strength necessarily. So tweaking the system so that it's you're optimizing the things that you want without shifting into a situation where you're creating even more deleterious effects, that seems to be the trick here, the sweet territory to get into.
Yes. Yeah. And so what we've found as a field is that these longevity pathways, insulin signaling, sirtuins, TOR signaling, these are actually nodes within a network. They're all talking to each other. Now, the question for how do you make a drug that's safe is where can you press that's safe and effective? Now, rapamycin is great in mice. It extends their lifespan. There's no question. But are there downsides? You know, rapamycin is has some side effects. So is it possible to make a molecule that can press on, say, the TOR signaling pathway like rapamycin does without having the downsides that come with it? And we don't know that. And this is one of the big challenges of the field right now.
So, in fact, there are papers about, as you said, TOR, target of rapamycin, treatment being useful and helpful. But on the other hand, as we know, that's something that you give people when they're having an organ transplant, and it compromises the immune system. So there's pluses and minuses here. And the system that you're talking about there was an interesting talk on day one, I suppose, from Daniel Promislow, where he was looking at the system's biology of all of this. That's, I would guess, a useful context, a useful approach to be taking here, because as you say, you can't just do one thing.
Right. Well, what we're finding and what Dan nicely showed is that if you press on one, all these other things happen. You press over here and all these other things happen. And that's also part of the confusing part about aging research is that all you have to do is push one button and so many other things happen, and it's hard to know what it is in those responses that's responsible for the benefits. And so we're pushing here and we're knocking out or deleting things here and asking, does it still work? Yes or no. Change this, does it work? No. And over the next 5-10 years, I think that's what we're going to do as scientists, is push here and change things over here and see if it still works or not, and put together that network that Dan was talking about.
Yeah. So what your advice is, I kind of asked you this before, but let me try it again. If you were just sort of giving somebody advice about the best way to improve their longevity, keep your telomeres long and skip dessert, but...
Yeah, well, my best advice would be, if you can, be born 100 years from now.
Oh, okay.
That would work. But for those of us who are born possibly a little too early, the best thing I know of is to watch your weight. Really, food kills you. I've seen a lot of studies showing that maintaining a lean body weight, and if you can, even below that, but I can't do that. But just don't become obese, because type 2 diabetes, obesity will accelerate aging. There's really no question. Now, what if you do watch your weight and you're lean, what else can you do? Well, some of this is just born out of clinical studies. We don't even know how they work. For example, fish oil. There's a lot of evidence fish oil works. It's anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. We have some work going on in my lab trying to understand how fish oil works. We might have a clue, but I'm not going to talk about it yet. Why don't I just say what I do? And it's not advice, it's just what I do. So I take fish oil and aspirin. I'm on a statin for high cholesterol. And I take some resveratrol just in case it's going to work. And I can't afford to wait to find out if it's going to work or not. Other than that, I try to stay thin. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm hopeful that we'll find drugs that will be prescribed to patients maybe 5-10 years from now, when many of us develop these diseases. Because I know that they're treatable, we just have to figure out how.
In terms of, just one last thought though, just in terms of communication of information, you have to go through peer-reviewed process. I'm just thinking, this is, as I said, said to you before, this is, you know, this is the 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society. Shortly after that, Oldenburg became the first editor of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, first peer-reviewed journal. So we had this 300 and almost 50 years of peer-reviewed journals, and that's the way in which science proceeds. There are peer-reviewed articles and so on. Now you have the blogosphere.
Yeah.
We have newspapers cutting back on their science pages. So, you know, highly qualified science journalists out of jobs. Mm-hmm. And you have, as you've discovered, a lot of information turning up on the blogosphere,
yeah,
which is not subject to any kind of critique.
Right.
Is that irritating you or what?
Well, I think it's a step backward, because the bloggers have day jobs typically. They can't be expected to know the science as well as the people who do this professionally. Now, you know, even for saying this, I'm probably going to get, you know, people criticizing me. But you can't expect bloggers to know the science as well as scientists do. But they espouse their views and they're read, and they do change public opinion. But there are some very good bloggers, so I'm not saying it's all bad. Certainly nobody talking about science is worse than a discourse that is going on. There is one area that I think is if not dangerous, just irritating, and that is the anonymous posts. Now, anonymity brings out the worst in people, and what I've seen is that these posts on the web are malicious, vicious, not just to me, but people who have devoted their lives to trying to help people are just having horrible comments and, you know, sexual allegations and complete rubbish. And it's that I think is, you know, it used to just be bathroom gossip, now it's out there for everybody to read, and I think that's a step backward.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about how hard it is to navigate your way through this. And I think not only the blogging that's going on about the pharmaceutical studies from the other drug companies and so on, even global warming. If I try and read both sides of this, and I'm not particularly unschooled in some of this stuff, it's very, very difficult to navigate your way through all these pluses and minuses and pros and cons. When you get to something like the Karanti blog that you're talking about here, and papers being cited, it's very difficult for somebody, and I'm actually doing this stuff about aging, to actually navigate through all these papers and figure it out. So I'm just saying that although it's interesting to raise these issues, it's awfully difficult for the average person who reads a blog to actually come to any kind of informed decision about it. That's what concerns me, and I assume it concerns you as well. I don't know.
Well, it hasn't ended my career yet, so it's not that bad. But for instance, you mentioned the Karanti blog. The guy who's writing this stuff is unaware that there's literature out there in PubMed that he could find that completely disagrees, a whole bunch of papers that disagrees with his point of view. But I think he just doesn't know the literature, and he can't be expected to know this. But yeah, it's frustrating because he's forming public opinion. Yeah. But the good news is that science is self-correcting, and the people I talk to here who are experts in the field have reasonable expectations and reasonable views. And so there's two worlds. There's the scientists who aren't fazed by controversial stuff because this is how we live. And then there's the blogosphere where, you know, everything's fair game.
Yeah, but are you ever tempted to, and this is where I'm going with this, because you almost get the sense that when you've got these critiques going on, whether it's in this area or global warming or any other area, that's in certainly the global warming area, some scientists themselves have started blogs. Have you been tempted to at all start your own blog to rebut any of this stuff?
Well, I'm actually pretty busy trying to do the science. I have a Twitter site, but what I use that for is to tell people about new papers that come out. Right. It's more educational. You know, my point of view, you know, I share at scientific meetings. I don't have the need to, or the time really, to be putting it out there. But I think it is important, though, for scientists to talk about their science to the lay public, rather than just have people interpret stuff. So, I mean, that's why I'm writing a book that should be readable by non-scientists about aging.
Right.
And the goal there is really just to dispel some myths, to talk about the future of the field and where we're headed with this.
Yeah.
And so I fully believe in allowing the public insight into what we do here. It's such a little closed world. But the bridge shouldn't be the bloggers, because they just don't know the science. And they're inflammatory. That's how they work.
Now, we talked about the book. I knew you were working on this. How's the book progressing? How are you finding the time to do it anyway?
Well, after this interview, I'll go back to my room and work on it. Yeah, I'm also taking a risk by doing this book, by the way. I don't think most people realize that scientists are criticized for writing anything that is accessible to the lay public. I'm going to be criticized for this book, there's no question. But, you know, I tend to do stuff anyway, so we'll see how it goes. I think it's still worth it, because there's such a gap between the average person who's a non-scientist, because they just don't have the time to keep up with things, and the world of the scientist.
You have a delivery date?
Later this year.
The year's just started.
Yeah, it will be in the second half of the year.
Second half. And title?
Well, the tentative title is Just in Time, but I'm told that the editor wants to change that. I don't know. The thing that surprised me about writing a book, and maybe this is why more scientists don't write books, is that you don't have the final say. And that's pretty dangerous as a scientist. And so I've been heavily edited, and so I'm making sure that it's accurate. But yeah, it may end up with a title that I hate, but I can't do anything about it. So hopefully I'll be able to convince them that we don't go with something like The Resveratrol Miracle, because that would be the end of my career.
Well, so probably we'll have another conversation before we get to there, but it's nice to get the update. And David Sinclair, thanks very much.
You're welcome.